Hey there, it's Frank Buckley. Today it's a fascinating conversation with a brain surgeon, not someone who jokingly calls himself a brain surgeon, but a real-life brain surgeon and a scientist at the City of Hope. He's someone many of you will recognize. My guest is neurosurgeon and scientist Dr. Raul Jandial. He's a regular contributor to the KTLA 5 Morning News, and his day job involves providing surgical treatments to people with cancer and researching cancer and the brain. Dr. Jandial is about to take us inside the brain and inside the lives of some of his patients with the real-life medical conditions and issues they've had to face. You can also read about all of this in Dr. Jandial's new book, Neurofitness, A Brain Surgeon's Secrets to Boost Performance and Unleash Creativity. Here's my conversation with Dr. Raul Jandial. Dr. Jandial, it's great to have you on the program.
Thanks for including me.
Yeah, and thanks for this wonderful book, Neurofitness. I really enjoyed reading it. And I was struck by a number of things. Among them, just the way you get us into the story. And part of it is just your first day as a surgical intern. And when you first cracked open a head.
Yeah.
And we see the anatomy of the brain. And I was surprised at what we would find if we got to look inside. Tell us what it looks like.
I was surprised. I went to medical school. You think you've done, you know, anatomy 101, which I hated because that's not really what anatomy looks like. And then you've gone through surgical rotations and you think you've seen it all. And then you get to see or actually perform brain surgery. And the first thing I noticed was how hard it is to get to. So the concept is really simple, that the most important things are encased in bone. So your heart's in your chest and your brain is very delicate and floating inside your skull.
Floating. That's floating. The other thing, right? Because people think, oh, it must be attached, but it's floating.
It's floating. It's like a giant jellyfish packed in an aquarium. If you lose that fluid, like when women have a baby and they get a, quote, wet tap and they get a gnarly headache, that's because they've lost that buoyancy from the fluid. Mm. If you get into a car accident or you play football and you get a concussion, that's the brain sloshing against the inside of the skull. So the brain tissue should not touch bone tissue. So it's floating. And I remember they opened the skull and I was there the first time I saw it, and this clear fluid bathes over. And it's odorless and it's clear, but it still has proteins and chemicals. Right? That clear, I've never seen clear fluid in the human body. Like the stuff in your eyeball is not clear.
Yeah.
And then I remember it's white. And I remember having learned that it's 3 pounds, but gets 20% of your blood flow. I mean, there's so much blood, 4 arteries going into your brain. Why is the flesh white? Mm. And so it is this heavenly marble. If you think about it, it doesn't make sense in the sense that there's like, you know, flesh and bone. It's predictable. Thigh muscle looks like heart muscle.
Yeah.
Thigh bone looks like breastbone when you cut it up, you know, and even in the neck and the spine. But it was such a unique tissue. And I remember it was the first time I thought, are we supposed to be doing this? And that also was my interest. And
right.
That's how I started the book, because since we all have brains, we're all in some ways experts about the brain. And I just wanted to make sure people knew I was coming from a unique vantage point.
Yeah. And just to get back to the narrative, when you go into the brain, it struck me as both delicate and amazing and also medieval. Mm-hmm. The way that you actually literally drill into a person's head.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is also, so my son saw, my teenage son saw my, one of my colleagues and I, we did brain surgery a couple weeks ago, and he was a student observer. And that's what he said too. It's like, you know, you always see it in the movies and it's like the most precise tiny instruments, but you got to crack the coconut. And there's, it looks like a car shop. I mean, the same hoses that they take off the bolts with, you have to drill. You have to crack open a little bit of the splintering bone. Mm. And then it's covered with a sheath. It's not like you see brain immediately. And that sheath is what traps the fluid inside. So you have to pluck it up. It's like parachute consistency. You pluck it up and then you snip it. And you stick your finger inside sometimes, or a little instrument. And then you see this glistening, shimmering brain. It's white. And on the operating room lights, it's not like the rest of the body where you have these predictable branches. You know, they're almost like tree branches. Nature, the way rivers are, the branching in trees, and the branching in our body is sort of like that. But in the brain, it's a lot more like art, like a Jackson Pollock painting where he's just dripping ink all over the place. The way the blood vessels are, they're fine, they're serpentine, and it's just something exquisite to see. I mean, and under the bright lights of the operating room, it is just the most unique thing I've seen in my life. And I'm trying to go to museums. I'm trying to live a full life.
Yeah.
It still remains the most beautiful thing I've seen.
And you talk about how many neurons, how many brain cells we each have. It's an astonishing number. And then you include the synapses, the connections.
Yeah, so to me, people who are fascinated with space, I don't get it. Because to me, there's more complexity in the human brain. And for a while, we thought, like, you look at this tissue, it behaves like tissue. Well, it's different. If you put your finger in brain and you push, you'll just go right through. It won't bounce back like muscle. It's tissue, but it's more like flan. You could move your finger through it. So the surgical technique is different. But what I remember was we used to think, meaning the scientific community, that it was like a giant ball of fishing wire, like, you know, fishing line is all connected. Mm. And 100 years ago, somebody showed that these 90 billion neurons, think of them as microscopic jellyfish that make a hole. And their tentacles, they get close to each other, but they never touch. So now you've got 90 billion neurons with 10,000 branches reaching all over the place, never touching and shooting dopamine. And so all those drugs and Prozacs, they work where the neurons almost touch like a lover's kiss, but they spray chemicals at each other. And that's really important to me, that people look at the brain as a multifaceted personality, if you will. There's structural. If you have certain types of dementia, the brain will wither. Mm. There's chemical. Prozac leaves more serotonin in those gaps, those almost touches. And then there's electrical, the signal to release serotonin or dopamine down the arm of a neuron is an electrical pulse, much like the wires in your house. Mm. So when you think about it as electrical and you think about it as chemical as well as anatomical, then we can get into the discussions about how we can improve ourselves, or in this disease, which part is affected. So depression is mostly thought to be a chemical issue. So Prozac is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. What that means is when you shoot serotonin, it doesn't mop up the space as fast. The vacuum is turned off, leaving more serotonin in between those neurons and having you feel better. Mm. So when people start to see that my medicine works through a chemical basis, I feel like that empowers them to understand what it is that they're taking, as well as, hey, that's baloney what I'm hearing now on the websites and on TV even. Maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you give us information that we can actually use in our own lives when it comes to our own brains in this book. One of the things that struck me, since we're talking about drugs, my sons, when they're in high school, there was a lot of talk about, hey, you know, I heard so-and-so is using a certain type of Adderall or whatever it was to stay up later, to think straighter, that was helping them get better grades. And you sort of talk about that. Tell me what you found.
Yeah, I put it's called smart drugs and stupid drugs. And I mentioned, you know, being in Bolivia with my son and having coca tea. So I'm not afraid to get into what the reality is. I just want people to know, if you make good decisions or bad decisions, that's up to you. But I just want you to remember that, well, he gave it to us straight, and then we went down the path we went. As of now, there is no non-prescription drug that's going to make you smarter. Is there going to be a huge industry for it? Absolutely. I mean, we've got Viagra, we've got steroids to run faster. In my mind, there's no question in 10, 20, 30 years, when they do come up with medicines to help with dementia, that people without dementia will use it to get an edge. We're not there yet. So when you hear Adderall, Ritalin, coffee, all these drugs do is help you focus and have more intention and endurance. That by itself might make you think you're smarter, but it's not helping you develop more cognitive powers. It's just helping you be more focused on the task at hand. Mm. So whether that's ambition or a cup of coffee or a little bit of Ritalin, it's more about attention and focus, not like, hey, I'm going to have a better breakthrough now. So I think that's a misconception about these nootropics and Silicon Valley microdosing with these things. They're just attention and focus enhancers.
Yeah, because people are saying that they are microdosing LSD, and there are all these testimonials that you read about, hear about, that, hey, this is a wonder drug if used properly for a brain? And to that, you say what?
And that I put into the creativity chapter because Steve Jobs was really into that. And some of the biologists who have discovered things were on acid in Berkeley and Marin County when they're trying to figure out DNA. And because biology is structural, it's art again. The way that the DNA helix is really a beautiful thing, and so you have to have a three-dimensional perspective to understand biology. Now, microdosing with LSD, it started off as a military drug, and they have these strange videos where they sprinkled in the air or in the water, and nobody could march in line. And I love that visual as well as metaphor, if you will. Now, what these psychedelics do, and you may say, well, why is a cancer surgeon talking about psychedelics? And I would say that in New York, psilocybin, another psychedelic, is being tested in clinical trials with cancer patients who are having an existential crisis of a cancer diagnosis, that something inside me is eating me. And they're looking at this in clinical trials. So it is a space I'm familiar with. And then the neuroscience part of it that I can say is that psychedelics, see, what happens is, because, as we mentioned earlier, 20% of our blood flow goes to the brain, it wants to run in the lowest gear possible. It doesn't want a red line. Mm. That just means you got to find more food in a competitive environment. So it likes to fall into ruts and habits just to tamp down how much it's burning, how much energy is burning. And those habits are getting home, tying our shoelaces, checking our emails, getting things done. But that goes against creativity. And what acid does, and whether you put it to good use or not, that's secondary. I mean, you have to be driven also. You're not just going to sit at the park, drop acid, and make iPads, right? That's right. Also sort of a misconception that you don't have to be at your A game to be creative, like it's an aha moment. But what I say is, what it does is it temporarily disrupts all the freeways in Los Angeles. So it forces you to take roads, and by that way, you find yourself in different corners of the landscape, which you may not. Mm. That might be purple elephants, purple dragons. That might be a new perspective on how iPhones should be. You know, maybe they don't have to have the buttons like BlackBerry. Maybe they can be smooth, which is really pioneering at that time. So that's the neuroscience between what psychedelics do is they allow the waves of thought. And it's like a swarm of birds. An aurora borealis is flying around your brain. Mm-hmm. It'll go this way to tie your shoelaces. Use vision, use hand coordination. And acid will let those thoughts and those electrical storms flow into different corners. Mm. If you can channel and harbor that for creativity, better luck to you. But that's the concept behind why microdosing has become popular again.
And just so we don't romanticize it or make it make people think that it's some sort of easy road to creativity, there is a darker and dangerous side to it as well.
All of these things are addictive. All of these things we can buy in our gas station from cigarettes and alcohol, they all have risks.
Yeah.
And even chemicals you don't ingest can hurt you. So gambling is a very interesting thing to me because you don't put a chemical in, but it'll give you the same behavior as being a coke addict.
Mm.
So life has pros and cons, risks and benefits. And my, you know, sort of hope is just to share with you the real knowledge so you're making an informed decision despite the road you go into. But yes, you know, psychedelics are illegal, so I'm not officially suggesting that people do that.
Yeah. Back to the brain itself and all of this information that you know and everything that you've studied and you've seen it, you've held it, you've fixed people. But then the other thing that you reveal in this book is how little we know.
Yeah.
How little we've tapped in terms of our knowledge of the brain.
And then why it surprises me when people write confident things like, this is the address for creativity in your brain. Happiness lives here in your brain. And that sort of absurdity of taking the universe's most complex thing that is so dynamic from birth through life and giving it little bullet points and bumper stickers, you know. And as neurosurgeons, I can tell you, we do things and patients get better. And many times, we don't know why. And the example that is most dear and difficult for me as well is, you know, when those electrical storms in our mind that are our thoughts and emotions and feelings, they can have an arrhythmia, just like you can have an irregular heartbeat. You can have an irregular brain beat, if you will, and electricity, and it's called a seizure. And there are medicines for that. And and there are treatments for that. And there's this really severe type where the only way we can keep the kids from having a seizure is actually to put them on a breathing machine like they're getting surgery. Mm. We just got to put them on a machine and put them on the Michael Jackson drug, and they're under anesthesia. Mm. In those, some of those dire situations, there's an option. If it's from the right side, we remove the right side of the brain. It's called a hemispherectomy, like cutting off half of the planet.
Mm.
And I remember this from, you know, my good friend of mine, Mike Levy, is a pediatric neurosurgeon. I do a lot of pediatric brain surgery around the world. But, you know, the next day the child is awake, but the left arm and left leg is because the right brain controls the left half if you were split down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't move, and she's, you know, young. And it's a difficult thing. I mean, it's, you know, the people, it's like everybody thinks, oh, you're healing, you're helping. No, there's a lot of torture and demons and tragedy that comes through the whole process too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This one was very difficult because the child didn't give consent to this brain amputation. The parents were happy because their kid's awake, but she's like, I can't move my left side. So a couple of years later, this is just when like email was becoming popular and dial-up, and I can't. And there's a video, and she was running around, just kicking a soccer ball. Yeah. And then I thought to myself, how? You're like, you get back to your question, like,
yeah.
You guys know what you're doing? Not really. So she came back for a brain scan. And that part, it was still hollow. Now that's plasticity. It's not rewiring. I don't know what these computer metaphors are, but it didn't grow back. It wasn't like a liver that grew back,
right.
You know? It wasn't like a lizard's tail that regenerated. The remaining half of her brain took on new roles, repurposed itself, shape-shifted to control her whole body. That extreme example, I think, should be an inspiration to everybody about how dynamic the landscape is inside our mind. Those 90 billion microscopic jellyfish are not a static thing.
Yeah.
If you're in depression, that's not a static thing. If you're happy, that's not a static thing.
Yeah.
And to me, that's empowering, that example of plasticity, that a brain cell that can work to move your arm, or contribute to that in an ensemble, under different situations could actually play a different role for vision or sensation.
Yeah.
That's real plasticity.
Yeah. You talk about, you have individual patients and their stories scattered throughout this book, and each one is fascinating. There was one about a woman named Marina. She was a 33-year-old English teacher who was asked by a student, I need something to write, and she couldn't remember the word for pen. She came to you, and you eventually got into her skull, and started this surgery. And I was astonished to find out you did it while she was awake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, and we've been doing awake surgeries for 50 years. So a lot of these things in here, people have been like, "This must be riveting, new, leading edge, cutting edge." And no, I'd seen in black and white textbooks from 1950s. Though,
but to us, it's to me, I was like, wow, you're touching this person's brain while she's awake because you need her to speak to you.
Yeah, she was the co-surgeon. And the interesting thing is the brain only feels through its emissaries. If you have a brain exposed and you touch it, they won't know you're touching it. It can't sense its own touch.
Mm.
It only feels through the nerves it's sending out over every millimeter of your body. So although most things are global in the brain, interestingly, language tends to be left temporal. It doesn't have an address, but it has a neighborhood.
Okay.
If you have a tumor in that neighborhood, because there's no address, you don't know how to get to it, because the tumors deep in the brain, whereas all the thought happens on the canopy.
Mm.
If you think of the mushroom as a design of the brain, the cap of the mushroom is where all the thoughts are happening. The stalk is how it's sending those commands down to your arms and legs.
Mm.
Or if you look at a tree, it's at the tree tops. So what if you have a tumor deep in the brain? You got to go through that canopy to get to it. And if the tumor's deep to the left temporal lobe, you got to make sure you don't go through language-relevant tissue, because there are approaches to the brain, deeper parts of the brain, where you can go through things and patients aren't injured. So to know that, we have to wake you up and have you talk. And then we, through a tiny electrical current, we'll stun little splotches of brain tissue. And if you can talk while I stun it, then I realize this is not really contributing to you talking. If I stun it and you go 1, 2, 3, and you just mute button.
And that happens sometimes?
Oh, yeah. It's called speech arrest. It's literally a mute button. No matter that they're trying, the volition is there. And so then we put a piece of confetti on there, and we put a red confetti, like, do not go through this. And so that's called speech mapping.
Wow.
And the most fascinating thing is, if I go through a learned tongue, you'll have your mother tongue. So she was Spanish than English. But if I go through the mother tongue, you lose all learned tongues. So if she grew up in Chile and she spoke Spanish and English, we came to an understanding that to get to the tumor, I would go through English and she would lose English, but I would never go through Spanish because then she would lose all language, and it's better leave a little tumor behind that scenario. That's neurosurgery to me. That's why I love medicine. People keep thinking it's like, you know, and then just as a little side riff, like you got like people with sleeveless scrubs and that whole world of medicine is there too. But then there's like, can you imagine sitting with a stranger and having a conversation like that with her? Like, do you mind if I have to get all the cancer off a potential cure? Are you willing to lose English, but you'll still have Spanish? I mean, that's a conversation, Frank.
That was a real conversation.
Yeah, and that went down, and that's how it happened. So I held on to that story for years and thinking, when I get a chance, if I get a chance. And the Vice article that I wrote set this up because I started telling stories that I think show, I mean, there's no like real medicine or not real medicine. There's just the world of medicine that I see. And I just feel like people should know, like, it's not even a job. It's like if you're a student of human nature and you like to do stuff, you like to travel, we're on the airplane to London together, there is no greater aquarium within which to understand people than a hospital and those sort of things. So I like operating. I enjoy that part, but it's the patient stories that have kept me engaged the longest.
Yeah.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Let me ask you about another story. A young man in his 30s named Theo. He walks into the ER with a gunshot wound to the head. And you wondered, would he be a talk and die case? Mm-hmm. Explain what that means and tell us what you did with Theo.
Well, I don't do these kind of, like, the podcast thing is different because there's no, you know, it's a longer, deeper dive. And thank you for that. This connects back to how we met, actually. So the talk and die thing, everybody first understood when Liam Neeson's wife had, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name wrong, but, you know, the actor, his wife, Natasha Richardson, in Canada, fell, had a blood clot. She fell, she got knocked out. The brain, the jellyfish were stunned, and then they woke up. But a blood clot was blossoming between her brain and her skull, and it hadn't pushed on it enough to hurt her, but it was growing. So she was talking, and then later on died. So that's the worst thing is to... Not that it's bad when you come in near death and die, but there are certain brain surgery things where they come in and they're talking, and then you can lose them because there are these secret things expanding inside their skull. And so, when I grew up, you know, in East LA, Boyle Heights, went to medical school and all that, New Year's Eve, people shot guns straight up in the air. I mean, it was a thing. It was, and then there were those campaigns to shoot them into your lawns and different things because the bullets would come down. And people think all parts of the brain are the same. It is such a different landscape in there. It looks different. It behaves different. You can actually get shot in the frontal lobe and drive in. And I can't explain it, but it's established. And we've had patients like that. And there are other parts of the brain, the stalk of the mushroom cap, the reptilian brain. The same reason, like in ancient times when there were injured soldiers, they would push something in there to the reptilian brain is where you no longer have consciousness and you really just are completely paralyzed and you pass away. So there are parts where if you bump into it with a neurosurgical instrument, you can hurt them. And then there are parts like the frontal lobe where a bullet can go through there and you drive yourself into the ER.
Yeah.
And I want people to know that it's a very dynamic landscape going on. And he survived that injury without consequence. But we lied to people and said, you can put on a helmet, bang your head against a wall or somebody stronger than a wall coming at you 4 times a week through high school, college, and NFL. And then we thought that, you know, you're safe. The ABC used to have those things, right?
And I know you're going to get into CTE and football in a second, but I want to get back to Theo for a second because I want people to understand what happened. You say 42% of people who are shot in the head,
they live.
They survive.
Yeah. So they're, back to Theo. The reason he was going to talk and die was we knew he was fine because he drove in, but there could have been a surprise blood clot that was blossoming that we didn't know. And that's what happened. We brought him to the ICU. We checked some scans, where the bullets went in. The tear in the arteries was blossoming. So I went in there and singed them and took it out. Two operations, two ice fishing holes, chipped off the bullet. And like a week or two later, he went home without any consequence. So that's also a way of looking at plasticity and resilience.
Yeah. We'll get to the concussion question and should my child play football in a second. But one more case that I want to talk to you about. And that was the 91-year-old man who came in to see you, a doctor himself. Mm-hmm. And it's this idea of how old is too old to get surgery. And you also, in this book, sort of remove some of the preconceived notions that we may all have about things like that. Tell me about this gentleman's story and your encounter with him and what happened.
Yeah, he was alpha. I kept, you know, I was like calling him doctor this. And he's like, don't call me doctor, because he knew where I was going. He knew that in his own way that there's ageism, that we put all 90-year-olds in the same bucket and all 70-year-olds in the same bucket. And I remember one of the defensive coordinators for the Steelers was like 78, and he's so sharp running those plays. And I just thought, you just can't put brains. You might be able to put bodies in the same. That's a 75-year-old body, and that's a 70, you know, thigh muscles, runners, Usain Bolt. But the brain, if you keep it engaged and it's been active and it's firing, you could have your best years in your 70s and 80s. And this guy was, even though your body might look like it's withering.
Yeah.
And the surface, the brain itself can look like it's withering, but because we now understand it to be electrical and chemical and not just structural, you could still have beautiful aurora borealis of thoughts going on in a withering brain, or you could have a juicy brain and never put it to use, and it's not at its peak potential. And this guy was, you know, we have to do this like mini mental ecstatics exam, like, oh, do you know where you're at and what the year is?
Right.
I'd skip that with him.
Right. You like, knew on, this, that was I mean, not necessary.
He was dominant in the conversation. He was quick. He knew what was going on. He was emotionally connected. And
he had a subdural hematoma.
Yeah, this is a similar type that Natasha Richardson has. Hers was epidural. But again, it's a blood clot between the surface of the brain and the inside of the skull. And when that blood grows, the skull's not going to stretch, so the brain gets pushed on. Mm-hmm. And it grew. He didn't want his arm to be weak. He wanted to read the New York Times, the LA Times, and be on his phone. Like, he had plans for himself. How dare I, he made me feel like, what do you mean? You're not, if I want it, then I'm willing to say, I'm willing to take the risk. Why are you balking? Yeah. It really taught me something. Hmm. The surgery went fine, but I remember looking at his brain. It looked old.
Yeah.
It wasn't a good kind of wrinkly, you know? It was an old brain. I thought, what it taught me was, brain, so we see a lot of this press coming out like, oh, the Alzheimer's brain, demented brains are withered. It's like a prune. It's the volume has gone down. But that's when I learned brain atrophy does not mean mind atrophy. Hmm. That you can't just simply say my brain's smaller, so I'm not as smart.
So, and just so we're understanding what you're saying, you're talking about the physical atrophy that can happen to the brain doesn't necessarily mean that
your thinking, complexity, cognitive power is not only linked to the juiciness of your brain.
Okay.
Because we talked in the beginning about structure, electricity, and chemistry.
Yeah.
His electrochemical connections were
still
just
firing big time.
Yeah. And that was an important lesson for me. And I saw this interesting study just the other day. There was an Alzheimer's convention, and they found that these are just association studies. It doesn't mean if you work, you won't get dementia. But women who had joined the workforce were starting to show lower rates of dementia. And so what I tell people is it's thirsty for a challenge. If that's, puzzles for you, it's a high-power career for you, if you're just in a poker playing, whatever it is, engage the world, engage a book. And that's what this doctor had done. I think, you know, he worked till late. He loved to get out. He was doing his thing.
Yeah.
He didn't stop going for it. He was thirsty for challenge. And that by itself is the exercise for this thinking flesh. We know what to do with our thighs. You know, you run upstairs. But the brain is a thinking flesh.
Yeah.
So think, feel, go and engage yourself with the environment around you, and it's free. Yeah. Nothing in there is selling anything. Right? The best things are already accessible to us.
You do some myth busting in this book, and sort of to continue on what you're saying, you take on this idea that brain training is bogus.
It's not bogus. It's not. But it's not easy either. Mm. So I think some of the government agencies are doing it. I know the guy from Atlanta Falcons, the quarterback, was doing it. Tom Brady was doing it. That's for reaction time. Brain training is a surrogate, is a shortcut when they get to the right model of what a life well-lived is. Hmm. It's basically engaging complex situations, getting out to church, driving, traveling, all these things. If you can't do all those things, it might be able to put in a video game for you for decision-making and reaction time. There have been studies that show that older folk, people who are less young, when they do those brain training things to keep track of things that are flying by them, that they have better reaction time when they drive. It's not a mystery. I just think what happened was some companies came out too early, made too many claims, got spanked, and now there's this like, does it work or does it not work?
Because some of us want to think, oh, if I subscribe to that program, or if I do more crossword puzzles, or if I challenge myself by trying to learn a language, this will keep my brain vital as I get older. Is that true?
I think it's true, but it doesn't replace all the other things. There is no, if I play this brain training game for 30 minutes, I don't have to exercise, I don't have to think, I don't have to be in an emotionally positive place. It's a supplement to what you're doing.
I see.
And back to what you said about learning a language, if there were two things that recruited the most corners of your brain, got it out of idle, the second, third gear, it would be learning a musical instrument or learning a language.
Huh.
It doesn't mean you have to be good at it. That's
but
the
just,
trick.
It's the just attempt.
Just the intent. Because language pulls from a lot of different corners. A musical instrument brings in your hand, coordination, and music. And when you look at those fancy brain scans, not that they tell the whole story, but you don't. There's nothing more than playing music or a robust communication that is sending electrical waves and lights all across the skull.
Yeah.
And so, again, those things are nearly free to us and they're accessible to us.
Let's get to brain injuries, traumatic brain injuries, and concussions. And this ongoing question we have specifically about football for typically young men. And some children, and then also soccer for everyone, and the ball hitting people on the head, and other injuries that one may have, and other contact sports. Parents want to protect their children, but they also want to have let them have these wonderful experiences.
Yeah.
I played football.
Yeah. And you turned out okay.
We don't know.
To be determined.
We don't know what I could have achieved, doctor.
Yeah, that's true.
But the question is, should I let my child play football?
I think that's a personal question. I'll just answer that directly. It's up to you, but we shouldn't have misinformed you about the risks. Should you smoke? That's not for me to answer. Should you smoke cigarettes? But we shouldn't have misinformed you when we said they weren't causing cancer and causing diseases. It's the misinformation we need to correct, not the taking away, in my opinion, taking away of freedom to make bad decisions. And so what I would say is, this is a very simple thing to me. We described in the open how delicate this brain is, right? Like, it's buoyant.
Yeah.
If I asked my kids to go bang their knee against the wall 20 times a day, a couple times a week for 10 years, I said, no way, I'm going to mess up my knee. Why do we ever think that would be anything different for the brain? Mm. And it's that chronic nature. So tying it back to the gunshot wound, one piercing through your frontal lobe you might actually handle real well, but banging your head on a wall 20 times a week for 10 years causes a different kind of brain degeneration.
Yeah.
chronic traumatic encephalopathy is a fancy word for over and over banging your head. And encephalopathy just means wearing out your brain tissue.
CTE is what
it's just a fancy name for you're going to wear out your brain tissue like you would wear out your knee tissue if you bang it against a wall over and over again.
Even if I'm wearing a fancy helmet, the state-of-the-art helmet that's protecting my skull.
You know when you drive on the freeway and there's those hard merges and they put those orange trash cans so that in case you, so you don't hit the dividers hard?
Yeah.
You still don't want to crash into that.
Right.
It does lower the smack of the brain hitting the inside of the skull, but it doesn't take it away. So now that you know that the repeated hits are dangerous to the brain, not every time, but they're going to pose a greater risk, then you can say, how do we play smarter? And the most important thing is that there aren't checks and balances at the ground level where people are playing. And there should be parents on the sidelines that have been given a role or a coach or a trainer or a physical therapist that says, if they got a concussion, we can't put them back in. Because remember, chronic is over and over again. You have a concussion, you sit out for a few weeks, you play again, that's different. You have a concussion, you haven't fully healed, and you go back in, that's dangerous. So I think if you bring those measures in and you let, we knew boxing is dangerous. That's punch drunk. I mean, but people choose to go into boxing. They were never lied to that boxing was dangerous. Football raises the risk for having brain injury and long-term consequences. Don't be surprised. Now that you know, make some smart decisions. And if that's your way of getting out of a difficult situation, if that's your opportunity to pull your family out of a difficult situation, I'm not here to say no. I just want you to know the truth about those things. And a lot of times our language obscures the obvious. So CTE is banging your head repeatedly against the wall. Yeah. It's going to wear out the flesh of your brain. That's no surprise.
And is it different with soccer balls hitting my head? If I'm heading the ball on a regular basis, am I putting myself at risk?
I don't know. But those risks, I think, are not as repetitive as football. And we remember when you, you know, as you said, you're taught to lead with the head. There, it's constant. So I think heading the soccer ball here and there, kids falling off of the kitchen table here and there. I mean, my kids have. I mean, it's parenting. The once in a while knock seems to be well tolerated. Something about the persistent and consistent banging of the head against a wall that leads to this kind of disease called CTE.
We talked about the things that we can do in terms of brain training and trying to keep ourselves vital. Are there other things that we can do that we should be mindful of as we move forward in age to keep our brains in the best possible condition or to make them even better?
Yeah. So let's not forget that it is flesh. And the same arteries that feed your heart, they say go up to your brain. So if you don't keep your arteries open in your body, you're not going to keep them open in your brain, and you're going to have splotches of brain wear out. So exercise and heart health are important. Number two, it's a thinking flesh. So to exercise your brain, you have to think. You have to get out of the ruts. You have to try new things, new experiences. So don't forget that, engage the world and challenge yourself. It has a thirst for challenge. Number three is it needs nutrients, but it's not the same nutrients that that your body needs, because it's a unique flesh. It's very fatty. Fat serves as conduction, like the wrap around a wire, so the electricity can bounce around faster. So we talked about irrigating the flesh, so keeping the arteries open. And we all know how to do that now, because over the last few decades, we've been taught about heart health, keep your cholesterol low, control your blood pressure, don't have diabetes, or keep diabetes in check. The other thing is this thinking flesh, so let that mean whatever it does to you, but it is thirsty for a challenge. It'll fall into a rut unless you push it out of it. And the last thing, it is a unique chemical composition. It's fatty, and the fat layers serve to spread the electricity faster. And so the mind diet is basically a Mediterranean diet, which says plants, yogurt, nuts, occasional red wine, and fatty fish. The omega-3s in fatty fish are actually part of the conduction wrapping around the neurons. The wrapping is made of that type of good fat. So that's a way for you to understand some nutrients my brain actually needs. Those fall under the mind diet, and you know, that should be easy. That's not asking people to be on a strict diet. Just cut out the red meat, the processed food, the sugars if you can. There's still a lot of good stuff left to eat.
Right.
And if you want to lose weight, eat half of it. But if you're going to eat, eat the stuff that your brain wants to have.
And is olive oil, avocado, mm-hmm. are those kinds of good fats too?
Yeah, all of those, yeah. Okay. All the things we've heard are actually constituents of the brain's landscape.
Finally, I want to talk to you about what's ahead. What's coming that you know about that we don't know about when it comes to the brain? What are you excited about? And what will we be excited about in a year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now?
Yeah. So again, that's great. So structurally, we are trying to inject and replace those jellyfish, swimming up the arteries and actually squirting brain cells into damaged areas to rebuild the structure. For dementia, those are some thoughts. Electrically, we're finding... a long time ago, I think, like in Italy or something, when people had bad migraines, they'd like zap people with electric fish on their skull. They knew there was something electrical going on. And just like we can read the electricity with those brain waves, people are getting into more sophisticated technologies where magnets can change the electricity. And some people have shown it can temporarily even improve like your painting abilities. So there's a whole landscape of helmets and things. Right now, it's all gimmicks. But there is a future where you can modulate the electricity in your brain through magnets on the surface of your skull. That's not baloney, that's real. Because electromagnetic fields, they intersect. Electricity creates magnetic fields, and magnetic fields create electrical fields. And then the one I like the best is living medicine. So whereas before we cut the cancers out and then maybe leave chemo, now we're thinking about putting in cells that are continuing to battle while the skin has been closed for weeks. So medicine that doesn't just work and then, you know, come out of your system, that stays behind and is like a Star Wars in your brain, those 90 billion neurons and maybe a billion cancer cells that are trying to take over those 90 billion neurons. Now we put a million CAR T cells or something in and they are going right after the cancer cells only. It's like an intergalactic battlefield going on inside your skull. So I'm excited to learn about that. You know, it's a great place to be for me.
Last question. In what you do as both a scientist and as a surgeon, some of it is life and death. And you see people in the best of their moments and in the worst and in the most difficult moments. And what can we learn from your interaction with those people and the grace with which some of them live their final moments? What can we learn from that?
That's a tough question. That's an excellent question. You know, they have people ask me, like, oh, you work at a cancer center. It must be so tough. And I said, no, these are heroes. These are heroes. The grace and the courage and the tenacity with which they fight for life, moms that continue to raise their kids even though they've been diagnosed with breast cancer, they inspire me. And I think what we can learn from them is what I learned also last year when my father passed away, that that sometimes the body shuts down before the brain does. And sometimes the brain shuts down before the body does. And so you have all these variables, but it does shut down. And I'll say very few of the people I have seen in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, very few, some of course, because they're suffering, they've had difficult things, they all want to live more. And the way they've guided me to living more is to actually live more with the time we are given, not necessarily get into. They're not saying I want to be 120. They're just saying I wish I would have soaked it up more. If I knew this finish line was coming and how it's unexpectedly brought close to me through a cancer diagnosis, I would have soaked it up even more. And these are well-adjusted people. You know, these aren't people who led destructive lives and they're looking back and saying I wish I should have. No, these are people who have had a wonderful life saying, I would have tried to soak it up even more. So many lessons from cancer patients. Thank you for asking me that.
Of course. And thanks for spending this wonderful time with us and for this new book, Neurofitness.
If you'd like to see my conversation with Dr. John Dial, tune in to KTLA this weekend. We're on at 8:30 p.m. on Saturday and at midnight on Sunday. And we'll post the show to YouTube after it's aired on TV. If you enjoyed today's audio podcast, I hope you'll subscribe. We have more than 160 episodes with fascinating guests who you can listen to on demand. And of course, it's always free to listen. If you have some feedback on today's show, tag me on social media. I'm Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram, and there's a Frank Buckley Facebook page as well. Thanks for listening today, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.